Committee on Health and Human Services, reform to order. We have a quorum present. In first order of business, members will move the minutes for February 3rd. Do I have a motion to move the minutes?
So moved.
Whoa. Okay, we have Representative Kelly, Representative Lohmer, and others move the minutes for February 3rd. A lot of enthusiasm. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
One moment, members. We actually have a change to the minutes. I'm sorry. all that enthusiasm for nothing. We have one change. It was accidentally recorded. We have Representative Allen as being here yesterday, and she was not. So she will be marked as excused from the committee yesterday. So you can just take note of that. So do I have a motion to move the minutes as amended?
So moved.
Okay, Representative Schumacher moves the minutes of February 3rd as amended. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Members, welcome to EMT/EMS Day in Health and Human Services. There's a theme to the bills today, and thanks for all the people that have come to support them and testify. So the first bill that we're going to be hearing is House File 188. So if Representative Neuberger wants to come forward. And Representative Neuberger, welcome to the committee, and I will be moving that House File 188 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Mac. Appreciate the time to move this bill and to present this in front of the committee. I'm Representative Neuberger, most of you know me. The bill that we have here before us is House File 188. As a background for the members who don't know and for those in the audience, I am an EMS professional. I climbed into the front end of an ambulance when I was about 24 years old, and I'm still stuck in the front end of an ambulance. I work for a major trauma center in the metro, and I've done about approximately 16,000 ambulance calls in my career and counting. So I have a little bit of a background on this, a little bit of experience. What we're talking about today here is the collection of data. EMS is a system that's dynamic, that always builds upon what we've learned, what works, what doesn't work, how to save lives to be more effective. The data that we've been collecting for years, we've been doing this for decades, has been managed by the EMSRB. Which is an entity that's been around for a while now. They store and collect this data, and they use that for furthering our industry and to make life-saving more proficient. This is important data. We use this data for heart attack care, stroke care, trauma care. Whenever we make a decision pertaining to emergency decisions, we always go back to see, you know, what we've done in the past. Unfortunately, there's been a development recently where the entity that oversees this data, the management of it, the EMSRB, is having some problems. I'm going to be kind here. They're just no longer able to sufficiently manage this data. So at this point in the game, what we need to do is we just need to hand the ball off to someone who can. We're not really doing anything new here. We're just transferring the responsibility from one entity to another. So we're going to be requesting that the Department of Health take over this, the acquisition and the management of this data, because really at this point in the game, they're about the only ones that can do it seamlessly. And with that, I stand for questions, and I avail myself to your good graces.
Okay, thank you, Representative Neuberger. Members, are there any questions for the author? Okay, I do realize we have some testifiers here to testify. Representative Neuberger, are the folks with you there wanting to testify at this time?
You guys want to testify?
Madam Chair, if there's no questions, would be good. We could stand for questions.
Okay, well, we do have one other testifier that we'll bring forward at this time, Twyla Brace with the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And I'll just encourage testifiers, and if there's anyone else from the public, this deals with a few different issues, but we'll keep coming to the jurisdiction of this committee dealing with health policy. So with that, Ms. Brace, if you want to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, and testifiers will have 3 minutes to give your testimony. So thank you, Ms. Brace.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, a nonprofit national healthcare policy organization located here in Minnesota. We exist to protect healthcare choices and patient privacy. Today, I come before you because House File 188 expands government power and government surveillance in patients' lives. Government surveillance has become a huge issue across the country, and concern is growing, not receding. We often say, he who holds the data makes the rules. But when it comes to healthcare and the treatment of patients, doctors and patients should be the ones making rules in health in patient care. Thus, we're concerned that this bill allows the health department to use the data that they will collect to drive policies which may restrict access to doctors, penalize doctors for customized care, or limit patient treatment choices. The Minnesota Department of Health has police power. It has already developed a master patient index to allow all data collected from at least 50 state databases to be attached to a single person. We oppose taking advantage of a vulnerable time in a person's life to expand the state's police power into their life. If the ambulance groups want to collect this data, then they can contract with a private entity to do so and get informed patient consent to send it there. Patients care about privacy. In 1999, long before the Minnesota Electronic Health Records mandate went into effect last month, the California Healthcare Foundation found 15% of Americans choosing to protect their own privacy by doing things that may harm them, such as falsifying questionnaires, refusing to tell one doctor about another doctor, delaying care, or avoiding it altogether. Now to the bill specifically. Starting on page 1, line 21, the data to be shared with the state includes demographic information of the ill or injured person, information about the date, location, and cause of the illness and injury, information about the condition of the ill or injured person, and information about the treatment, comorbidities, medications, and provider impression of the ill or injured person. Look also at lines 2.14 to 2.18, where it says the state will improve ambulance services quality, develop treatment protocols, and improve outcomes. We don't believe this is the job of government. This is the job of the private sector, which government often impedes through its regulatory requirements. Now, I forgot to ask the page to pass these two out, but if there is a page close, that would be great. Can you give one to... Okay. Here's the other one. So I'm sorry that you do not have it yet, but I will describe what I'm given to you. So I have a handout describing the Minnesota Electronic Disease Surveillance System, which says the surveillance system is a person-centric system where all information collected is organized around a single person. And the second page has a diagram of what this system looks like, which includes that it combines all these 50 different data systems that they have into one. They also have, as I said, the master patient index to hold it together. So here's the one that I'm drawing your attention to, which is a diagram of the system, and it also, because I didn't think you would know what all the acronyms on it, we wrote in what they are. So you've got the cancer surveillance, the birth cervical screening, the women, infants, children program, birth defects, blood lead level, sexually transmitted diseases, vital statistics, so birth certificates, etc. We've got newborn screening, newborn early hearing detection, traumatic brain injury, immunization registries, all these together. And so this would be another piece of data that would be added into the system to an individual. Essentially what we're doing is creating a profiling system on patients. So instead, we are asking the committee to recognize and act on the privacy rights given to Minnesotans in the state constitution, Article 1, Section 10, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. That is our request, and thus we oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grace. Are there any questions from the committee for the testifier? Okay, thank you, Ms. Brace, for being here. Appreciate it. Are there anyone else that wants to testify from the public that's here? Okay, members, any other questions? Representative Neuberger or... Oh, excuse me. Sir, if you want to come to the table, if you could keep your comments to 3 minutes, please. Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
This is Rick Heller. Thank you, committee. It's one, what's the name of the bill?
This is House File 188.
188. My name is Rick Heller. I unofficially represent the twice exceptional print disabled. When it comes to personal data, Minnesota Chapter 13, I think it's relevant how we collect that. It's one thing that it's transparent and to who, but one thing the committee, the legislature needs to consider, that since it's collected electronically, that Chapter 13 is silent on how it becomes fully accessible.
And I think it's relevant. Mr. Keller, just for one moment, just so this bill will be going to the Data Practices Committee, which deals with all issues related to Chapter 13. So we're trying to keep testimony and conversation to issues related to health policy today. Just if you could narrow your comments to that, please.
Okay. It's my understanding then the CDHC is going to collect this data from third-party agencies. And if they are, does it meet statute requirement 16E? Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you for taking the time to come forward and share your comments. Representative Neuberger, do you have any closing comments? I don't think we have any other questions or comments from the committee at this time.
I do. Thank you, Chair Mack. I appreciate the opportunity. I would like to thank Twyla Brace for coming up to testify. I consider her to be a friend of mine, and I appreciate her insights and her input. And it's something that I don't take lightly. And all of the privacy, the data collection, and the data management is clearly something that we're going to vet through in the Civil Law Committee with data practices. And that's something that we've been working on here. And there are some parts of this bill that will change before it gets to that committee in that regards. But as far as health and human services for policy, what is pertaining to this committee, one example that I can give you right out of the chute is how important it is to study medicine and to study data and to track trends would be survivability rates. When I first started working as a paramedic, if we had a drowning, if it was a cold water drowning, after about 6 minutes, we would just pronounce them dead, usually. You would extract a child or you'd extract someone, a boater or ice fisherman, from the water, and you'd look at your watch and you'd establish a downtime and you'd say, well, it's been about 10 minutes, we're done. There's really not much we can do here. Over the years, we have learned through tracking data and doing case studies that that's not always the case. At this time, if we pull a child or a young adult out of cold water, that's like in the wintertime like now, we will work a cardiac arrest, a drowning cardiac arrest, even if they've been down under the water for up to an hour. We've had survivability. We have revived people that have been down that long because we have learned through tracking data and doing data studies that people can survive this if the water temperature is right and if the age is right. So tracking data and doing data studies isn't always evil. How we manage data, that's a different story, and that's something we're going to address in the next committee. But for the health and human services policy issue of this bill, I strongly stand in support of this, and that's why I'm here before you. And I would ask that, I request that we move this bill to the next committee as Chair Mack sees fit.
We do have a question from Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Neuberger, in light of just the training effort for collection of this data, my first impression is, aren't the EMSs already collecting this in an informal way and relaying that verbally to the medical staff when they enter a hospital anyway?
Representative Neuberger.
It's not anything new that is being collected.
Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It isn't anything new that the EMS professionals are collecting. We're just more formalizing the data collection in a process-driven way.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Chair Mack. Representative Albright, you are correct. We're not collecting anything new here. This is the same data, the same type of data sets on these patients that we've been collecting. We give patient reports and we bring patients into the hospital, but this data, it's the management of it in order to advance our emergency medical practices. So nothing new, no new data is being collected. It's just how we're managing it. And I want to go back and reiterate, this data has been managed in this way for years, okay? The only thing we're really doing here is the agency that was managing the data, doing it all last year and for decades past, they're no longer able to do this for their own internal issues. So what we need to do is we just need to transfer the job of managing the data to someone who can do the job. And right now, the only entity that's capable of stepping up to do that job is the Department of Health. So by default, it's their baby. They can raise it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, members, seeing no further questions or comments on the bill, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 188 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. Members, next we have Representative Davids with House File 189. Representative Davids, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 189 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. With that, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 189, the proposed legislation transfers the authority of the 8 regional emergency medical systems from the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board to the Minnesota Department of Health. And I have with me here today Mr. Buck McAlpine, to go over the bill in more detail.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Mr. McAlpin, if you want to introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, Buck McAlpin, representing the Minnesota Animal Association. As the previous bill of Representative Neuberger's, this was two programs that we've identified that and talked with the EMS Regulatory Board, the Ambulance Association, and the 8 regional EMS programs that Representative Davids just alluded to. And the big issue is just resources of the board. They've been underfunded by FTEs. It's kind of a very unique board that it's general fund supported, where many of our boards are license fee supported. This one, how we set it up, is probably part of the industry's fault in 1996. It is 60+% of our folks are still volunteers, so it's a little tough to go out and put a fee on them. So as we looked at a better spot to align cardiac data, stroke data, trauma data, and what Representative Neuberger alluded to about outcome data, this bill and the last bill are two pieces that we wanted to move there. The regional EMS programs are in support of this, and we're just going to work now in the Department of Health in the Finance Committee on what some of the costs will be with Representative Dean to place these programs over there.
Okay, members, any questions for the author? Representative Plum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm just curious, looking over the appropriations in that section, you've got the overhead, the oversight, etc. Will there be any fees or dollars taken out to cover that, or is that being absorbed within the global budget by the department?
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, our goal is that we ask for an appropriation to the base to help with that transfer, and MDH is working now on a fiscal note for that for the next committee if we pass out of this one. And otherwise, we would have to have a discussion with the board and the regional programs about what that would look like if we took it out of their base.
Question from Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author or the witness. I noticed that you said the problem was that the EMSRB doesn't really have the staff to oversight this, and that we need that this would work better. But I note that on page line 19 on page 2 that the grantees, the regional units, are going to provide oversight of the regional programs, and by creating a committee. And I'm wondering whether, I'm not as familiar with how those work in each of the regions, but whether they have the capacity to do that, or whether there should be a role for the central MDH staff in that oversight thing. Are we just going to kind of take an overwhelmed statewide group and put it to overwhelmed regional groups without really having an agency that has the staff and the time to do that. And if you could just comment, I'm still learning about this area.
Sure.
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, Representative Loffler, that's a great question. There are 8 regional programs, and one piece we talked about we may amend in the next hearing is we've never identified in this statute what these 8 regions are. The board's issued these RFPs to them. I put RFPs out for years for the 8 of them, and we're probably going to number them to identify what counties they're in. But each one of them, it's about an even mix of joint powers boards. The Rochester one's a joint powers board. The Northwest EMS and Arrowhead are not-for-profit associations. So unlike any of us could apply as a not-for-profit or a joint powers board, to it would be now the Minnesota Department of Health to review an RFP that meets the needs that they put out in that region to meet some area-specific needs. 7 of these are in outstate Minnesota, and 1's in the metro. The metro one focuses more on bioterrorism issues, large healthcare, EMS coordination issues. So really from the Department of Health standpoint, it would be managing grant administration. And then currently today, these are all out there now set up with some folks that have been doing this for nearly 25, 30 years probably, have managed these programs. And Madam Chair, if I can add one quick thing, because I think this is a good point. An issue that's came up over the years, and it's not just the money issue, is this board is made up of peers. Interim Chair J.B. Guyton here is the Woodbury Public Safety Director. Many folks on there work for our EMS agencies. And J.B. could vote on a grant that would come to my ambulance service that him and I worked on, and there were some issues the AG's brought up in the past about, is that a conflict of interest? And over at Health, putting out the RFPs, that would not happen, and then the board truly functioned as a regulatory and licensing board, and we have to continue to work with the legislature about how to appropriately fund that board to really work on those issues.
Representative Loffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm starting to understand how it's operating. I had some concern about, it sounds like the metro area, which is, you know, half the population, is working differently than the rest of the state, and whether or not that's good or bad, I can't comment. I mean, we obviously need coordination in the metro area if we had something huge, and I'm glad they're working on that. But it may mean that our local services maybe don't have as much access to operating money. I'm not sure. So just learning, and but still want to make sure that whoever it has the resources to do that and to do effective oversight on behalf of the taxpayers, and that it's a fair process, whatever we set up.
Members, any other questions? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 189 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Representative Davids, you have House File 213. And members, I will move that House File 213 be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members, for passing House File 189. Now we have before us House File 213. This would sunset a 4.5% rate cut to the ambulance and non-emergency medical transportation providers. As you know, some years ago, our budget was in some pretty rough shape, and in many areas of the state budget did take some cuts. On this one, what we would do is sunset the rate cut. So I'll turn it over to Mr. McAlpin to describe further.
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair and members, this is one that we brought forward this year. There's also, I believe Ms. Aberholden will talk, the Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Advisory Council. That's a group that we work closely to that I believe will be bringing forward a legislative initiative that may also lift some of this. We hope working with them that these could run parallel as that moved forward from the ambulance providers, and we'll talk about a bill of Representative Schumacher's pretty quick here. Really focusing on rural Minnesota this year from our ambulance association. These rural non-emergency providers, there's about 8 large ones left in the state, and if we don't have non-emergency transportation in rural Minnesota, they turn to the ambulances to take home folks from the hospital and nursing homes. And we don't think this is a lot of money, but it's something that's been asked for by both groups to replace. And one piece is to it for the non-emergency side is the replacement is for certified special transportation providers by DOT, so we make sure we keep that higher level of certification and that when folks ask for a non-emergency vehicle, it's one that's appropriately staffed and equipped. And we appreciate your support.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. Members, any questions? Representative Quam and then Representative Liebling. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to mention, Rochester being the third largest city, their service, non-emergency medical transport, used to be 7 by 24, 365. They have had to cut that down in hours and days covered because of they can't afford it. And if the third largest city in the state is having that loss of accessibility, we should be worried.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Davids, for delving into this issue. What I understand about this issue is that it's pretty darn complicated, and that's why we've had this non-emergency medical task force working on this for a really long time. I think the chair is on that task force, if I'm not mistaken. And it is, no, maybe not, okay. But so I understand that Sue Abderholden is going to maybe speak to this bill. I hope so. I'm looking forward to hearing. And maybe I'll get the answer to my question, but I wanted to really understand how this fits in with what the task force is going to recommend, because I'm looking forward to hearing kind of a holistic solution to the problem all over the state. And I'm not sure if this bill, does this bill remove the rate reduction for everybody, or is there still somebody that's left with the rate reduction if this bill gets enacted?
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair and Representative Leaving, this should eliminate it for the folks that it applied to. The only piece in there, Representative Leaving, is the DOT certified piece. And I know that came out of the work group last year in legislation we passed. There's a variance process, so folks can't make the DOT certification, but we're trying to get folks to be certified as providers and be sure that they're up to par.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I guess it's more of a, I should wait and see what the next testifier has to say, because I just want to make sure that what we're doing isn't kind of dealing with the problem piecemeal, but that we are able to enact a coordinated solution, because this has really been a problem. And I know in an area like Representative David's area and my area, you know, where people have to go a long ways to get to the doctor, it is a serious problem if they can't get the transportation. It pretty much nullifies whatever we're doing for them on the, you know, they can have all the insurance you want, but if they can't get there, they can't get any service. So I'm hoping that this year we can actually solve this problem, or at least move it forward anyway. Thank you.
Why don't we call forward our testifier, Sue Abderholden from NAMI is here to testify. And I believe you're speaking to this bill as well as it kind of addresses Representative Schumacher's bill, which is next, so we'll give you a little latitude with the time of 3 minutes. You can get a little longer being as you're speaking to both bills. So if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota National Alliance on Mental Illness. But I'm really here as the co-chair of the Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Advisory Committee. And this committee has actually been meeting for several years to address the concerns that were first laid out in the 2011 OLA report on non-emergency medical transportation. And the OLA recommended that a single administrative structure be established and that DHS bring a recommendation back in 2012. We didn't quite make it for 2012, but we did in 2014. The OLA actually recommended addressing a number of issues, such as including the length of time people are eligible for special transportation, the frequency of assessments, clarifying eligibility policies when special transportation is not available, and collecting key performance data. When the legislature created this advisory committee, which I will tell you has been a very difficult committee to bring together and to sing Kumbaya, very difficult to do, but we did actually come up with some very good recommendations, especially to look at things like preventing waste, fraud, and abuse. So last year, what you did is you created a framework for a single administrative structure, and you created modes of transportation instead of what we currently call ATS and STS. But none of it could be implemented because funding was not appropriated. So we currently have the status quo, and the providers, volunteers, and individuals have not had a rate increase for some time, and of course some providers received a decrease. There will be a bill introduced very soon. We actually just met this morning and went over a draft bill that contains the recommendations from the committee for how to move forward with both requiring vehicle and driver requirements and to fund NEMT, specifically the new modes, which include client reimbursement, volunteer transport, unassisted transport, assisted transport, lift-equipped transport, protected transport, and stretcher transport. And you'll note that we were talking about this by modes and not by the type of vehicle used. What we've recommended is an increase in the mileage rate for clients and volunteers because we want to really encourage people to use those very inexpensive modes. Right now it's 20 cents a mile, which is very difficult for people who are on very low incomes, frankly, to do, especially driving long distances. And the volunteer rate we recommend going up, frankly, 200% because they're driving with what you call no load miles. So if the person is in the car, they don't get reimbursed. If you're driving 120 miles and then you go back home, you're not getting reimbursed for that back trip, and that makes it hard to get volunteers to come forward. So we put a lot of emphasis on those two because those are the cheapest ways to transport people. The rates for providers would go up by eliminating the 4.5% reduction and increasing the funds for RUCA. So we have all three of those increases in our proposed bill. We have prioritized as a committee the funding requests if the full package can't be funded, but I think it's best to hear first why each of the pieces of the funding proposals are needed before we have to get down to that stage, because of course we're hoping that we don't. One thing I do want to mention is that we really have tried hard to reach consensus with this group and to work together. And again, I'm going to tell you that this has not been an easy job. But we were able to come to an agreement last year, and it's really too bad that there wasn't funding to implement it. And as you move forward this session, I hope you keep the recommendations of the task force in mind. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Members, any questions at this time? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. So I think I understood you to say that, this bill that we're considering right now is part of what you would be, what the task force would be recommending. So therefore, I take it you're not opposed to our passing it today.
Madam Chair, Representative Leaving, we're not. But we do want to make sure that the package that comes from the task force that includes increased funding for the cheapest ways to transport people are a part of this. Because, again, we can't, I mean, one of the, part of the discussion today was that if we don't try to get people to be the cheapest forms, then we're not going to be able to get the money to increase the rates to what they should be to make sure that the providers, you know, have viable businesses. So we really wanted to make sure that people saw the whole package together.
Members, any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Abderholden, for being here. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else who wants to testify to the bill? Okay, seeing none. Representative Davids, any final comments or anything you want to add?
Well, Madam Chair, I read a long time ago the book Shut Up and Sell, so I think it's about that time.
You're a wise man, Representative Davids. With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 213 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Next, we have Representative Schumacher with House File 380. Welcome to our fine committee, Representative Schumacher. If you want to introduce yourself and proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I would like to move this bill and have it re-referred to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee.
Okay, members, Representative Schumacher moves that House File 380 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Are there any questions or discussion to that motion? Seeing Oh, yep, we're not voting on that yet, members. We're just clarifying the motion. Okay, Representative Schumacher, if you want to proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 380 basically completes the funding plan from the 2009 legislation that established the rural urban commuting area for non-emergency medical transportation. These medical transportation services are reimbursed for an eligible Minnesota Healthcare Program participant who is going to a qualified medical service site for an enrolled healthcare with an enrolled healthcare transportation provider. No-load miles are currently not reimbursed, as you heard from the previous testimony, at any rate, which puts the transportation providers at a disadvantage because of the greater distance that many have to travel in greater Minnesota. This adjustment would account for the disparity as well as fully fund the 2009 bill for rural and super rural special transportation providers. And, Madam Chair, I do have the A2 amendment, too. I would like to move it this time.
Okay, members. Representative Schumacher has the A2 amendment to get it the bill in the shape that he would like, and he moves the A2 amendment. Are there any questions or comments on that? Seeing none. Members, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Representative Schumacher, any other comments to the bill? Members, any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel like a broken record here, but I just would like to, Representative Schumacher, could you kind of answer the same question as before? I always feel like I don't have a really good grasp of this area of policy, and could you just explain the interaction between this bill and the task force report that's coming as you understand it? Is this part of what they're doing? Is it consistent with what, if you know, maybe we need Ms. Albert-Holden again, I don't know.
Representative Schumacher.
I think that we have a testifier at the table here who would be able to help with that.
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, correct. Also some discussions in that proposed legislation around RUCA, and we're just requesting to do the same thing we did with that bill as parallel track those to Representative Dean as we look at the fiscal part. I believe RUCA in the committee's bill expanded it more broader than what we did. This focuses on the rural population of it, so that'll be a discussion with that bill as we move forward and support that.
Representative Lee. Okay. Members, seeing no further, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you have the amendment to change 18 and 50 miles to go 17 miles and over. Is that correct? What about on page 3, line 3.2? Do they still need authorization from a local agency if it's over 30 or 60 miles, depending on if it's a PCP or a specialist?
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair and Representative Schultz, that's correct. That has to be approved by the state usually.
How long does that
usually take? Schultz.
Sorry, thanks, Madam Chair. How long does that usually take for approval?
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, let me ask the gallery quickly. Is that pretty quick? Actually,
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, they said that ride usually comes in set up that way, so they know ahead of time if it's going to exceed what they're allowed to charge for without prior approval.
Representative Schultz. Okay. Okay, members. Any other further questions or comments? Seeing none, members. Representative Schumacher renews his motion that House File 380, as amended, be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill passes.
Next up is House File 361, and it's relating to Community Medical Response Emergency Medical Technician Certification, authored by Representative Tara Mack. Representative Mack, would you please move and present your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move that House File 261 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
And we do have one testifier who would like to present.
We do, and members, I just want to set up the bill that's in front of you. This is proposed legislation which would allow for the development of a new certification called the Community EMT. It follows along the lines of the successful community paramedic program, which we passed into law in 2011, which has reduced and a 50% reutilization reduction where community paramedics are able to follow up within 48 hours of a patient being released. The community EMT program is designed to be a gap filler for all parts of the state to bring timely follow-up for patients after leaving the hospital. There is actually currently a pilot project that's going on between the medical response units of Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, St. Louis Park, Hopkins, Minneapolis, and the Park Nicollet Health System, which is already seeing great reductions in their readmission rates. And so, members, this proposal is supported by numerous fire departments, the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, Minnesota Ambulance Association, and the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association. So we're excited about the great success of the Community Paramedic Program and what that's done the last couple of years, and hope we can build on that with this bill. And with that, I want to introduce Steve Coring, who's the Fire Chief of the St. Louis Park Fire Department, and who's also been operating the initial pilot program that I referenced.
Thank you, Mr. Coring.
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Steve Coring. I'm the Fire Chief for the City of St. Louis Park, and I'm part of a group of very engaged and collaborative fire chiefs and the Park Nicollet Healthcare System, who have created what we believe is a very successful pilot program that's quickly validating all the things that we believe would happen, and that is that by getting out to the homes, talking with patients in this early stage of discharge is it a great opportunity for us to make a difference and to reduce readmissions and to minimize the impacts on the 911 system. Our results and the interactions we've had with over 200 patients in this particular pilot have shown that there's a reason to potentially continue this into a program mode. And we believe that with the Affordable Care Act's mandates that this is a great way to create an opportunity to add value without creating redundancy. And through the process of the development of this pilot, we've actually been using very extensive and collaborative methods by which to create standard work. And we believe that not only is this can this be successful from a metro perspective, but this the benefits of this program, once adopted and really kind of finalized, is very easy to kind of move out or spread out into greater Minnesota and benefit other firefighters, other EMT programs throughout the state, which conversely then would benefit the community.
Thank you, Mr. Coring. Members, we do have a question from Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a couple of questions for the testifiers. One of the areas I'm kind of curious on is, as this is growing into a new area, is it helping with some of the fire department needs? And where I'm asking the question from is, I've had the unique experience over the last year to watch my son has become part of the local fire department. He's one of the EMT folks that takes a day off work and sits there on call all day, and sometimes they get calls and sometimes they don't. I know that fire departments are struggling with that manpower issue of making sure that they've got people available when the emergencies come up, and it's not a hardship for the people who are taking a day off, because there's some days my son takes a day off work, no calls at all. Other days there's six calls. And so it's a kind of a balancing act. I know that some of the fire departments in our area have struggled trying to find enough people to be able to fill the roles because they're paid on-call departments. Does this help address that situation?
Mr. Coring?
Madam Chair, Representative Fischler, that's actually a great opportunity to discuss. Because these are scheduled visits, it makes it much easier for you to create a staffing model then that actually builds opportunities for firefighters to make these visits, or EMTs to make these visits, and then because you're not doing that in a kind of a 911 world where it's very unpredictable and we're racing to these people's homes because of issues or concerns they might have had because of issues around their discharge, now we're able to plan that time accordingly, and that means that time can be scheduled and the firefighters can be either doing firefighting activities or scheduled activities for EMT. And thank you for your son's service to the fire service, by the way.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple more follow-up questions. Having watched, he's gone through his training for his EMT, and mm-hmm. You know, it looks like he may go further and go into the paramedic role. What I'm wondering is, this new area starts to develop, is this it kind of changes the scope of practice a little bit. How does this work into the current models? In other words, a little bit more detail, are the training programs established? What are the some of the protocol that's going to happen along those lines? Because I know you have certain hours you have to do to get your EMT certification. There's certain programs for the paramedic. So how does that fit in between, and how does that system all come together?
Mr. Coring?
Madam Chair, Representative, the great opportunity here is that this doesn't change our scope of practice. We actually stay very, very tightly within our scope of work and have developed through the course of this pilot a very stringent standard of work that allows us to consistently deliver within that scope of practice on a very, very regular basis. So the idea that we would change anything that we do today is not going to be required. The training that we have, we're all trained to the National Registry of EMT standard, and so that standard that's a given. Additional education and training that could be required hasn't been established yet, but today we know that we stay within that scope of practice. There's no reason to believe that it would change that, and I think the key is that we fill that gap and take advantage of an opportunity that nobody else is taking care of today.
Any more questions?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair, for continuing. And the reason I was asked, because I noticed in here that there'd be additional requirements that you have to have so many years of EMT, and then there's like a certification process that happens on that. So does that mean they're overseen by a medical board of some kind to get the certification? And that's kind of where I'm just, you know, because I was seeing that referred to as I was, you know, glancing through it. And so it just raised some questions along that line. How does it look? And, you know, part of it is, you know, trying to help encourage my son which way to go and what to look at. You know, so this is kind of where some of these issues are coming from.
Mr. Coring.
Madam Chair, Representative Fischler, I think that the way I would answer this question is that there are a number of things which are still developing in this program. I think that will be defined even more so by the pilot, and it's continued as we kind of spread the news a little bit about this. I think that the standards will only become more in line with what the scope of practice needs to be. Not necessarily, we're not trying to, you know, build something and then trying to make it all fit into our world. It's you know, we need to be adaptable, and we're prepared to do that. So whatever the needs are, then we will create a curriculum and a standard of work that delivers to that. But the idea here is to really eliminate redundancy and to fill a gap of service that really adds value to our communities, and that ultimately makes our citizens feel more secure and safe in their homes, managing their care in the privacy of their home.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm still trying to understand, we have a community paramedic program that was actually told to us would be help in the rural area, but it has only been implemented in the metro area, so far as my understanding. And now we're asked to drop it down to an EMT level of training, and could someone give me kind of a basic background on what the difference in terms of amount of training? I think of an EMT as someone who's trained to be an immediate, you know, on emergency first responder care, as opposed to someone who's doing home visiting, like a home nursing service or whatever. They're really more trained in chronic care and, you know, have a lot more pharmacological training, that sort of thing. And so I'm just trying to understand, you know, what's the difference here between these two levels, and why would a lower level be okay at this point in rural Minnesota?
Mr. McAlpin?
Madam Chair and members, Representative Loeffler, great question. And we did the community paramedic in 2011. The community paramedic is usually about a two-year associate's degree now. It's about 1,400 hours is the DOT curriculum for it. The EMT is about 120 to 140-hour curriculum of training. And the community paramedic, we've adopted in Minnesota the International Roundtable of Community Paramedics World National Curriculum around things that we do with everything from the chronic care management in collaboration with our home care nurses inside our systems and with the public health folks and everybody we work with in that arena. So the nice thing about the curriculum that a few folks have alluded here to today is our current community paramedic program is about 300 hours, about 100 classroom and 200 clinical, where they go out and work with our home health care nurses, our wound care people. So the difference is the community paramedics are doing more of some acute care stuff, where they can do some antibiotics, some minor wound care, some things like that, INRs, things now we used to have come into the clinic. They'll do an INR and off an SOP adjust their blood levels if they're on Coumadin. And we're really like with the community EMT program, with the community medic, just targeting those folks that don't qualify for home care or other services. And I think you had the great question, Reb Loeffler, the outstate from the metro issue. When we originally tried to launch this, we knew it would be very, very costly, and we had to turn to our large health care systems. North Memorial, I work with, has a very large community paramedic program, about 15 on. We have three on a day, 16 hours a day. We've saw nearly 9,000 patients with it, mostly in North Minneapolis. Minority, low-income folks that have no access to health care. We've been out and worked on some of those disparities and worked with Turning Point, some of the North Minneapolis-type clinics to develop just some spot where folks would access some initial health care. Now we've gotten to the spot with community EMT is we're all into this, which I agree 100% with the Nurses Association with. We're really quick to discharge people out of the health care system. And that's not because of a choice of health care. That's because of a choice of how we're paid. And what Chief Coring and the other services are doing now in Western Hennepin County is there is such an ungodly population that we have to track, follow, monitor, and keep out of the hospital and keep healthy, that we have to look at every resource to do that, whether it's our friends in nursing or whether it's turning to the local fire department and ask them to do a whole different model of care, just to swing by with Engine 14 in North Minneapolis and make sure when somebody left Abbott Northwestern at 11 o'clock that morning that their meds were filled and that they have a safe home to be in.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, that's helpful, but, you know, I do think 140 hours versus 1,400 hours is a really different level of training. And I think that no matter where you live in Minnesota, you ought to have access to the same confidence that whoever comes to deliver your care has the most appropriate care level of training for theirs. And we've had a couple of hearings in the last couple weeks that have been all about the healthcare provider shortage in rural Minnesota and loan forgiveness programs and other things that we're trying to do to make those viable. And part of the problem is that because the people who operate home healthcare services, home nursing services, public health services, it's hard with the scarcity of the population within some of those areas to really have a viable business model. And I'm a little worried that we put one more actor with billing authority in there and we destabilize it. And I don't represent a rural area. I probably shouldn't be speaking about this, but I'm just absorbing what we've heard. And I just want to make sure that as we're rolling this out and as the study goes forward, that you really think about maybe adding that to the study language, that they really look at how to dovetail those pieces together, because the last thing you want to do is certify EMTs and then find out that the nursing service that people are dependent upon for many more hours of care, not just, you know, episodic care, starts to get destabilized because that's a part of their business plan as well. And so I really do care that we have a comprehensive service. This might be the most creative way to kind of extend what's out there. I just don't want to take it over to the tipping point. Thank you.
Chief Coring or any response?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. You know, one of the benefits and one of the kind of the initial conversations when we met with Park Nicollet that actually created the greatest amount of energy around the idea of this pilot was that the fire departments are kind of the experts in scalability. We have, you know, a very intensive mutual aid agreements. We have the ability to work collaboratively back and forth across all borders. There really aren't any jurisdictional lines when it comes to a structure fire or a large accident on a highway. We saw this as an advantage to the medical community in that our staffing models can be moved up, scaled up, or scaled down very quickly. And that's how we work together collaboratively within this pilot, is that if for some reason the workload becomes more increasingly hard for our schedule that particular day, or we have a large structure fire going on, I can call a fire department who's also within the same group, trained to the same level, who can then step in and kind of offload or balance that work. So it creates less stress in the system for overhead and having to hire a whole bunch of staff that just sitting there idling waiting for the problem to happen. And we just use our normal system of operation to scale up and scale down as necessary. So the idea would then be to how do we create a better, that, you know, whatever that looks like, then maybe the fire service or the EMTs are the best solution because they already have the training on how to scale up and scale down, and we just figure out a way to integrate them into the solution. You know, in a way that doesn't create redundancy, but actually supports the overall integrated part of the system.
Thank you. Representative Kwan?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. The Neuberger bill and mutual aid and other things are examples of just how cooperative the efforts are, and frankly, most citizens don't realize how seamless it is. But for the testifier, I'm still assuming that all of this is done underneath the doctor's orders.
Today, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative. So today, everything that we do is under the discharge orders of a doctor. All we're doing is essentially reviewing the discharge paperwork with the patient per the doctor's orders. We are not delivering care. We're not changing care. We're not reconciling medications. We're doing nothing more than simply helping the patient, ask the patient, do you understand? And if they don't understand, then we are able to connect them with services in a much more expedited way back into their doctor, into their triage nurse, into the system to help them get connected so they can get their answers. It's not our job to solve those problems. It's just to be the facilitator to help connect them with those resources as they need them. And many times, if I might just, if you can imagine the discharge process, you're sitting in your hospital room, and if anybody's ever sat there and watched your loved one or yourself sit on the edge of the bed, the day they tell you you're going to be discharged, the minute they say you're going to be discharged, you sit on the edge of the bed and you look at that closet across the room, right? You're waiting to get to those clothes, your jogging suit and your running shoes, because you want out of that hospital. And so everything that happens from that point on really is not an attention-grabbing moment. They come into your room with five or six different colored pieces of paper with all kinds of directions, things you're supposed to do when you get home, medications you're supposed to pick up. You tend to shake your head up and down and say, yeah, I understand, sure, I got it, yep, no problem. Can I leave now? Then you get home and you find yourself perplexed by all the papers, all the directions, all the things that are challenging you. And so you sit there for a period of time, and at some point, your first instinct then is to just call 911. And the minute you call 911, then you're back in the system. And really, so if we can solve that problem, just get out there in front of it and say, do you understand it? And we know from the 220 people that we've seen, in addition to answering questions about discharge orders, we've changed over 30 smoke detectors and carbon monoxide alarms. We've set them up with food shelf recommendations, and I think as many as 10 people. We do a physical assessment of their home for safety and trip hazards. So this is a larger project than just, you know, the medical side of it. It's really about community health, community resiliency, and I think that's the message.
Representative Mack?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just to that point, and to the concerns brought up by Representative Loeffler, building on what the Chief said, I think it's just important to clarify that, you know, the concerns related to the levels and hours of training, and the difference between the community paramedic and what we'd be proposing here with the EMT, they also would have the ability to do different levels of care. A community EMT wouldn't be doing quite the acute level of care that a community paramedic is doing, because that is according to the level of training is what kind of dictates what they're allowed to do on these visits. And so, you know, as the Chief just explained, a lot of this is, you know, basic health stuff that they could check and be trained in, but it's more than that. It's making sure that they understand those directions, that their home is safe, all the things that the Chief just laid out is really the role that they're trying to play in making sure to reduce readmissions and a tragedy after somebody leaves the hospital.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for those of you that aren't familiar with, well, for about a decade, my wife was the president for the local first responders, the EMTs. On their squad, they had, ex-military people that went through, they had people that went through a community college training. My wife had worked as a nurse. They had a couple physicians from Mayo that were part of the squad. My wife's delivered a baby. They go to resuscitate people. They have done push meds under doctor's orders. There's a lot of things that they're doing in just a few minutes to save lives. They are used to situations. This is adding a much calmer, easier, and structured thing that is within the scope that they've been doing. And it's right to be concerned, but frankly, in greater Minnesota, there just aren't the availability, the resources, and accessibility. And you don't have to doubt the training and capability of these people, because it'd be tough to count how many lives they've saved, how many people are resuscitated, and how many babies they've delivered.
Thank you, Representative Kwan. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Help me understand the scope of practice. So in lines 1.22 and 1.23, so it sounds like you can do some population health interventions. And did you just allude to that when you said, you know, checking on smoke detectors? Or give me some examples that would be at the direction of a primary care physician or care team.
Chief Coring?
Madam Chair, Representative, so the things that when we sat down and developed this program, we were very, it was intentional to be very inclusive throughout the entire kind of stratus of care, from doctors, legal, everything down through the Park Nicollet system all the way through our fire departments, to understand really what were we trying to accomplish here. And so when we talk about doctors' orders and the things that we're doing under physician care, we view that as really just helping them just go through the discharge. We get the actual discharge paperwork. All of the medical record that comes to us through from the hospital comes directly to us. So we have the actual medical record we're there with, and we're basically there as a resource to do nothing more than to answer those questions. Creating a healthy environment, a safe environment, making sure that food's in the home, making sure that they have access to questions about getting answers to questions they have about the medications. We help them create a, you know, they take, when you go to a home like this and there's hundreds sometimes, or certainly tens of bottles on the table, to make sure they understand, you know, going through their med list, what it is that the doctor wants them to take. One of the things that we learned very quickly was through the system that there's a lot of issues with the language in discharge paperwork, that patients' acronyms and medical terminology that get put into schedules and or patient paperwork that the patient doesn't necessarily understand. And so by going there and asking them step by step, do you understand this? And if they say no, then we simply have a hotline number we can dial on the phone. It dials right into the hospital, right into the triage nurse, or right into the doctor's office, and we connect them immediately with the nurse, the doctor, and they answer those questions. We don't get involved in that. So it's really about our world is protecting the integrity of the discharge order, making sure the patient understands it, and that they've met all the criteria that the doctor would like them to get to. And at that point, if they haven't, that we connect them up so they can get those things dealt with.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you. So you can only check on the food in the refrigerator if it's been directed by a physician. Is that what this language means? You can't do that otherwise unless it's been directed by a...
Chief Coring.
Madam Chair and Representative, the food is generally, food is not on a discharge order generally, and so, but we understand that food is medicine, and having food in the home is critical. Within the Park Nicollet pilot that we're currently in, there's also a pilot within the pilot that is designed to address the issue of food security. And the issues of food security are very prevalent in the seniors and low-income areas. And so our mission was to get in and determine, you know, if they have food, we know they have a greater opportunity for healing. And so this is the food thing is really kind of designed to meet the needs of the pilot within the pilot. But it isn't, and generally, doctors don't put in their discharge paperwork, you know, this many servings of vegetables or meat or anything like that. That's part of our assessment of the security of the home.
Representative Schultz.
So do you think that language is too restrictive then in language in line 1.21?
Chief Coring.
I have not. Madam Chair, Representative, I think the language is... I don't believe it's too restrictive. It just needs, everything is very clear. There is very little ambiguity about our scope of practice and what the doctor's orders are. If we stay within the discharge orders of the physician or physician's assistant, then we know that we're not extending beyond that. I don't think this is too restrictive. I think it just basically keeps us in the boundaries of the original intent of our scope of practice. And maybe Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. McAlpin?
Just if I could, Madam Chair, and Representative Schultz, quickly. We've used the term scope of practice here. Paramedics and EMTs in Minnesota do not have a scope of practice. We have a scope of training. We work under the direction of the medical director's license for our authority. So when it talks about being too restrictive, it's very broad what we can do, and that's what's been nice about EMS. That's how our helicopter crews do chest tubes and do very, very, very advanced care we want them to do, down to how we're able to have EMTs and first responders doing esophageal airways, give Narcan, epinephrine pens, nitroglycerin, things we never imagined somebody 50 miles from an ambulance could do that we can do. So it's really a scope of training, not a scope of practice like a medical practice board or a nurse licensure act. That's why all of our authority really falls under the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board.
Okay, we do have three more people on the list, so if we could wrap things up as quickly as possible, as we do have another bill to listen to. So, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Coming back in, one of the questions I had that I was going to ask earlier, I forgot, was knowing the model that happens often on the paid-on-call departments, how do you see, how does the pay occur for this? In other words, as you're providing these services, where does the funding for those services come from?
Chief Coring.
Madam Chair and Representative Fischler, today in the pilot program, we've been doing this at no charge. The fire departments who have been participating in this see the value, and we're doing it because it's the right thing to do. Long term, the strategy would be to find a revenue stream to fund this to make it sustainable. So the revenue at some point is going to have to come from somewhere. We don't anticipate where that is, and we wouldn't want to make any guesses. But there will have to be a revenue stream to actually sustain it.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. And just so right now, the communities are kind of bearing the cost themselves as the people are going out and doing these extra things are being paid, but the community themselves are kind of paying for that through regular tax dollars then?
Chief Green.
Madam Chair, that is correct. Yes, we've all been doing it kind of because part of the pilot, the benefit of the pilot is to begin to understand our costs of doing business and how we might create some efficiencies on our side as well as the hospital side. So once we end, the pilot will hopefully bear out where those are so we understand really what the cost model and the reimbursement model needs to look like.
And Representative, we do need to stay in the scope of the Reform Policy Committee, and that will be addressed in the Finance Committee as well. So shall we move on to Representative Freiberg?
Thank you, Vice Chair. First of all, I spent 9 years on the City Council in Golden Valley, and you know we have a volunteer fire department there that does a lot of the work, so I really appreciate the work Chief Coring and people who work in his field do. I agree with Representative Quam and what he said about the great work you guys do. My question kind of builds on Representative Schultz. I just had some questions about the language in the bill, so I don't know, maybe Chair Mack or Mr. McAlpin would be the appropriate person to answer it. I'm just lines 1.22. You know, there's just some phrases I'm not familiar with. I'm new to this committee, so I'm just sort of wondering about phrases like episodic population health support, episodic individual patient education, prevention education programs, and then again, like at line 310, diagnosis-related patient education, population-based preventive education. I guess I'm just sort of wondering exactly what those terms mean and how that would work for somebody providing those services.
Mr. McAlpin?
Madam Chair and Representative Freiberg. Episodic, that was talked about. The one thing we've done with community paramedic and with we want to do with community EMT is episodic means you just stop in once or twice. Now, I will say that we have some community paramedic patients we're seeing three times a week that just are on no coverage at all, that nobody else is seeing them, and we just see them to keep them healthy and keep them out of the emergency department. And there's folks that are just going to fall into that gap, and surprisingly, it's quite a number that we do. Representative Freiberg and Madam Chair, health support is, I think, what Chief Coring alluded to be sure their home's healthy and it's safe for them, that they have food in the fridge, that they have access to their medications, that they know how their medications are set up, where they can call the nurse line and where they can do things. And episodic individual patient education is to work with them on just that condition that they were discharged with, to be sure they can use that nurse line. And that's a big part of this, even for our community paramedics, is the one thing that we're doing in homes is to have that phone access to the pharmacist, to the primary care doc, and to the nurse and the our home health care nurses. This has developed a relationship with our home care nurses that we have never had in the industry, where we're looking and identifying all of these populations. And what else do we have in there? Prevention education programs. That can be everything the chief alluded to fire prevention talks, to what type of rugs you should have on the floor, should you have railings on your steps, just everything. When I looked at the program out there, very surprising what they were doing and where the Ambulance Association got behind it. Initially last year, some legislation we worked with them on that we had to bring forward this year needed some changes, because it didn't reflect what the community paramedic did, but it really reflected about the community-based care that Chief Coring talked about. So I think, Representative Freiberg, we're looking at those issues with this model of what we do.
And I'd suggest that perhaps you two meet and you can talk a little bit more offline regarding those, some of those details. And we also have, we can take one last question from Representative Boffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My concern is we do define the scope of practice, and we also create problems when we get too many people doing exactly the same thing. And there is a term of art that's population health that is actually owned by the Public Health Service, and that is it's their job to work on populations, the whole community, not individual patients who are referred. And so they do the anti-smoking campaigns, and they do, you know, a variety of things to make parents and kids and family members aware of things. They do a lot of the anti-obesity things. And population health actually has a defined meaning, and it's never episodic. And so I just would really encourage you, Representative Mack, to work with the Department of Health and, you know, sort through some of this, because I think that's part of the confusion of the committee, is that you've got some things here that are never episodic, because population health is when you're talking to everybody, not to an assigned patient.
Representative Mack?
Representative Waffler, thank you for the comments, and we would certainly want to clear up if there's any confusion or need to just readdress or play with the words a little bit to make sure that's clear. So I'll represent work with the groups that have been pushing this forward and the department to make sure that we're clear on that. So thank you for the recommendation.
We also have one testifier that has been submitted for to testify on this bill, and it's Carrie Mortrude. Is she available from the Nurses Association? So, Ms. Martrim, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Carrie Mortrude, and I'm a registered nurse speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association, which represents over 20,000 RNs across Minnesota. MNA supports increasing access to health care. We believe in the right care at the right time with the appropriate care provider, whether that's a community health worker, an EMT, a paramedic, a nursing assistant, a home health nurse, a licensed practical nurse, a registered nurse, advanced practice nurse, physician's assistant, or physician. That said, MNA has several questions regarding the creation of a community emergency medical technician program and concerns regarding care coordination and patient safety. MNA completely agrees and supports decreasing hospital readmissions and inappropriate hospital admissions. We firmly believe in primary care and prevention. We also support EMTs and paramedics receive compensation for addressing medical emergencies that avoid unnecessary hospital admissions. However, we cannot support a solution which seems to be treating a symptom of a bigger problem, like discharging patients from the hospital too soon and barriers to accessing public health and home health nursing. If patients are unable to access home health care, then let's deal with that problem. Specifically, we have concerns regarding the vague language and terms in lines 1.22 to 1.23, as we just talked about, episodic population health support, episodic individual patient education, prevention education programs, and then again on lines 3.9 to 3.11, interventions, care coordination, diagnosis-related patient education, and population-based preventative education. Nowhere are these terms defined. The legislation allows for EMTs to perform care coordination and patient education, does not allocate money nor outline requirements for training and education for EMTs to perform these duties. Without proper training in these and other areas, it puts patient safety at risk. We also have questions surrounding the communication between EMTs, the ambulatory medical director, the patient's primary care physicians. Who's actually coordinating the patient's care? Will the EMTs meet with the primary care physicians to understand their role in the discharge plan? Will the ambulatory director know the patients for whom they are giving care orders? Finally, given that these are no longer emergency services, which body will regulate the practice and licensure of community EMTs while they're performing these tasks? The Emergency Medical Service Regulatory Board, the Board of Medical Practice, the Board of Nursing? MNA praises the committee's desire and to increase home visits in order to prevent emergency room trips and 911 calls. And we support reimbursing EMTs for emergency visits that do not result in a trip to the ER. But we encourage you to solve this important issue directly and safely, and we ask the committee to please allow us more time to address these issues with the chair and the advocates. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm interested in your comment about which board is responsible. And it raises another question, which actually is maybe more appropriate for Representative Mack, which is, Representative Mack, what about liability issues here? If one of these folks, you know, injures a patient or something like that, who's responsible? Is it the medical director, or does their own insurance cover that, or is this something that's been thought through?
Madam Chair.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. I think I have an understanding of how that works, but we'll bring in an expert who's been working the pilot program. But I will also just speak to the comments from the Nurses Association. I appreciate the input. I saw this letter and was communicated with on some of these concerns just today, so I haven't had a chance to go over them in detail or sit with the Nurses Association regarding these concerns. And so I'm, you know, willing to work as we continue to move forward with this bill. But I do know that the association that has been putting this initiative forward has been in communication with the nurses and trying to address concerns. So, Chief Coring, if you want to speak to the issue of liability.
Chief Coring.
Madam Chair, so just briefly, we discussed this with the League of Cities, and we've met with them and talked through the program, the pilot. Each of the cities have weighed in with their city attorneys, and right now, until the contractual language is worked out from the perspective of back and forth, each of the cities is really the firefighters and EMTs who work every day in under these same conditions, those same protections are being covered by the city. So that's where the liability sits today.
Okay. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I have some concerns with this, the way it's written, but I commend the group working on this bill, because I know there's significant gaps in coverage. But I would encourage you to fix the language and work with the MNA Association, and then I think I could support it if you could fix some of the language and work with MNA so they're on board with the legislation.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mack, I guess that kind of states my opinion, too, and I had not seen or heard from the MNA until now when she came to the table. I hadn't seen this either, and I don't know if Representative Schultz had either. But I agree with her about the vagueness of the language, and I really actually feel kind of uncomfortable moving it along to finance, because it does have a significant finance component, but the things we're talking about here kind of belong here. And so does it have, I mean, this is its only policy stop, right? I mean, this is kind of our opportunity to work on those things and fix them. So I guess I would respectfully sort of suggest to you that you might want to hold on to the bill here, not pass it today, and try to work on these things a little bit more, at least the descriptions about what the folks are going to do and stuff. And, you know, I'd like to support this because I do think it's, you know, I think it's a, you know, it's a good concept. I think it's just not really ripe to be passed out of this committee today, though.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Liebling, I appreciate the concerns, and I think, you know, the intent is to make sure that we leave this broad enough to allow EMTs to do the work that they're able to do and meet the needs, but you know, also make sure that it's clearly understood and any of the concerns that Representative Loeffler brought up in terms of clarity. And so, you know, I guess I would support continuing to move it forward through the process. You have my commitment to have a conversation, certainly, with MNA. Again, you know, it's difficult when these, you know, the bill is up and I just hear about the concerns today. And so I don't want to stop the process at this point. It does have another hearing. If we can tighten up some of that language to bring clarity, we'll do that in the Health and Human Services Finance Committee just to get the bill in the shape that I would like it and to address some of the concerns. But at this point, I think that the intent is clear. I think that the advocates have done a great job of putting together this bill, and the great success of the pilot program is evidence that we are on the right track. So I guess I would be interested in continuing to move it forward, Madam Chair, and commit to work on it as we go forward.
Thank you, Representative Mack. Are there any other comments or questions? Seeing none, I'm going to renew the motion, House File 261, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
All right, the motion prevails. Thank you.
Okay, members, welcome. Representative Backer, we have House File 423 in front of us, our last bill of the day. Representative Backer, do you want to introduce or move your bill and introduce it for us?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I move that House File 423 be sent to the General Register. And also, Madam Chair, I move that the amendment labeled A1 be adopted also.
Okay, members, we have the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form that the author would like it. Is there any discussion to the A1 amendment?
I'd like to bring it up, yes, if I may. I served as an EMT for 19 years in Browns Valley, and one of the things in rural Minnesota, we have all EMT, paramedics, EMTs, fire department has something that they call mutual aid, in which when we have a serious run, we're getting help from, like for my service, Sisseton, South Dakota, Wheaton, Graceville. What we don't have is mutual scheduling. Unfortunately, in rural Minnesota, we have difficulties at time to fill scheduling. Last Wednesday is a good example. Of course, I was down here, my identical twin brother was down here, and a lot of people were gone. We had a very difficult time filling a 12-hour spot. What this does is it allows local ambulance services to call. First of all, we have to get a written agreement, just like we have with mutual aid, but once we have the agreement, we can call the local PSA, Wheaton, Graceville, Sisseton, other parts of the state, and have them cover for 4 to 6 hours, just so we can cover that care. It's only to the neighboring one, and it's also it allows rural ambulance services to continue to provide that care. And that's what that amendment have. I would take any questions if there is on the amendment.
Okay, members, any comments or questions on the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Backer moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Backer, to the bill as amended.
Yes. The other part of the bill has to do with a variance. Right now, just to give some history, if a service has a hardship like our service in Browns Valley, Minnesota, where we only have, at one time in 19 years, we had only 5 EMTs staffing 24 hours, 7 days a week. And we got a hardship variance from the EMS board to be able to bring on EMRs, which a lot of you are probably familiar as first responders. It's changed to EMRs. And what this bill does is it allows services to get that variance through the medical director instead of the EMS board. And Buck, if you want to speak on that too.
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, members, as Representative Backer did a nice job stating it. This is one that's came out of the MAA this last few months we've worked on as kind of a rural sustainability issue for our smaller ambulance operations. Like we said earlier, about 60-plus percent of them are still volunteer. And the small communities, like representative backers, we see this all over the state. And right now, the MSRB board does allow a variance process for the small rural ones. We decided, since the variances were usually issued and the process and length and the resources put on the board to do that, we'd just like to allow those folks to be able to use the emergency responder driver. We only have a couple states left that require two EMTs at that level. So the high-trained 120, 140-hour EMTs, always in the back with the patient. But we want them ahead of time to go down the street and talk to the fire department and put those four or five first responder drivers on their roster, approved by the ambulance medical director, so when the pager goes off, the ambulance gets out of the garage. And the second piece that Representative Backer amended on was exactly like he described. There's nothing worse than sitting in rural Minnesota and hearing four or five pages for the ambulance and nobody shows up at the garage. Mm-hmm. We want them to have worked with their neighboring community 10 miles down the road ahead of time to say, we have nobody on for 4 hours this afternoon, and page the neighboring service right away and not wait for 15 or 20 minutes to have the ambulance move. So we think it's a really nice tool to use for rural sustainability.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. Members, any questions? Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify to the bill? Seeing no one who wants to testify, we have a question from Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McAlpin, is there any input from the board? Has the board weighed in? I mean, I don't see anybody approaching the table to testify, but I just wondered if, you know, if they're in agreement.
If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. J.B. Guyton, I am interim chair of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, and I am the EMS commander for the city of Woodbury, not the public safety director that Mr. McNulty promoted me to earlier today. So I'll let my boss know when I get back. The board has not discussed this issue. We neither, you know, approve it or oppose it. There is the ability for agencies to get the variance today. What I do personally like about this is the ability, is the encouragement for services to talk to each other and try and work this out at a local level. But we have not, we'll be discussing this at our next board meeting.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. It just, you know, it sounds like getting this variance, it sounds like it's kind of a bureaucratic and perhaps unnecessary thing to go through the board, and that's kind of what I'm gathering from this, that, you know, so that this bill attempts to kind of just remove a layer of bureaucracy. Mr. McAlpin's like nodding in the back
there.
Is that kind of your understanding? And, you know, I guess I'm just wondering, you know, I mean, if that's the case, then by all means we ought to just remove that requirement. But, you know, is there no value that's added by the board reviewing these variances? Or is there even a standard by which they review them?
Madam Chairwoman, Representative, I think last year there were 14 variance requests that came from various size agencies. 13 of them were processed in 2014. There's still one that hasn't been processed. There is a theme where the staff at the EMSRB is pretty significantly understaffed, mm-hmm. and just struggling to get some of this work done, I think, has been tough for them. And that's why the two earlier bills that we talked about with regions and data have become an issue, too. Having said that, all of us believe rural agencies need whatever tools they can get to survive. And, you know, one of the advantages of this particular, as it's written right now, this bill as it's written right now, is the fact that it limits it to cities that are pretty much under 2,500 people. So we highly encourage rural sustainability. We want ambulances to survive. One of our biggest fears is areas in the outstate going out of business, and there's nobody around to take over for them. So without talking with the full board, I wouldn't feel any more comfortable saying anything more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. I'm not, you know, I'm certainly, from whatever everything I've heard, and Representative Backer talked to me about it before, which I appreciated. It sounds, you know, I think the goal is really a good one. I mean,
yes,
I appreciate the seriousness of the problem, and I'm going to support the bill. I just, you know, so I'm not asking you because I'm you know, be trying to be critical. I'm just trying to be a little more educated about what I'm voting on. So thank you.
I appreciate that.
Any other questions, members? Seeing none, Representative Backer will renew his motion that House File 423, as amended, be sent to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Members, just a reminder that our next meeting is next Tuesday, the 10th, from 2:45 to 4:30. And with that, we are adjourned.